From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Nice to have you with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. As Fashion Week of Rochester kicks off, we start our week in review.
Fashion!
Yes, fashion. With an extraordinary young designer.
I was joking because it's Fashion Week. I was joking because it's a bad joke. I'm not very fashionable. You're fashionable.
You're wearing a vest. Have you read the recent article about the vest, by the way?
All right.
Listeners, if you happen to catch the article about the fleece vest, check it out. Evan is not wearing a fleece vest.
It's not a fleece vest.
I know. I was telling them. I'm not wearing fleece.
I'm not wearing the uniform of Wall Street or whatever it was called, the Ivy League.
Yeah. Khakis, the fleece vest, the lanyard.
I don't even know what a lanyard is. What's a lanyard?
It's like when you wear your work badge around your neck.
Okay, yeah, I don't ever wear a lanyard, and I'm not wearing a fleece vest, but I happen to like fleece vests. Okay, that's why I'm not going to be in Fashion Week, but let's talk about someone who is.
Who is Christopher Washington. He will have his fashion designs featured on the runway this coming week, but it's the story of what did not happen in his career that we found so gripping.
Yeah, Washington wanted to play basketball for a living when he was growing up in Rochester. He looks back now, wondering why the adults in his life did not push him to prepare for the possibility that basketball might not work out. Let's listen.
Basketball was the only thought. That was the only thought I had.
How tall are you?
6'4".
6'4"?
That explains it.
How old were you when you could dunk a basketball for the first time?
I was 13.
13?
I was 13.
You could still put it down, I'm sure.
For sure.
Yeah, okay. But when did you start thinking that may not be the future?
When I stopped college. It was a crazy process to go from a basketball player to having to think about a job, you know, something I never, it was never that in my mind. So from there, I was working at Tops, and I worked in the mall, and I worked in a couple other jobs, and it was just like, yeah, this is not it.
Do you look back, because I imagine growing up, you know, first of all, there's nothing wrong with having a dream. Second of all, you could really play, and I get it. You're thinking that I'm going to work at this. This is going to be my life, my future. Do you wish someone had really kind of grabbed you and made you think, all right, basketball's one track. What's another track that's possible? Because it sounded like you were kind of a one-track mind to basketball.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, that's what drives me every morning that I wake up. I think about the number of adults that I cross paths with who didn't think to offer me anything more than just, you know, if you go over that screen better and shoot the three next time, we'll win this, or, you know, this will be the next goal. So I look at that and it's like, man, that's hurtful. You know, so now for me to be in a position with so many eyes on me, and like even before Fashion Week, just being like a motivational speaker, this is just like something that I have to get out there. It's like there's many options in this world to go for. Yeah, like that one track mind is not good for anybody. So me being there for the athletes as well, because I'm still very, very closely connected, is like letting them know, like, don't let them feed you, you know, just basketball.
Do they listen, though?
Definitely.
They do?
I say, oddly, all the athletes and all of the youth that I interact with, they all listen to me. I don't have, like, you know, crazy feedback and stuff like that. Like, they go for what I say.
Because you probably had a lot of cred with them.
Definitely.
And they understand, you know, your story. How old are you now?
28.
28 years old. And so I imagine they can really relate to what you're thinking. I also think, though, you know, I can't relate to kids who grow up with difficult circumstances. I didn't have difficult circumstances. I did not grow up in poverty. I'm thinking about kids who grew up playing basketball, playing a sport, kind of hitching their dreams to that, and no one has kind of given them another path. Is it hard for kids in those circumstances to think beyond maybe one thing like basketball?
Yeah, it's mind-blowing when you don't have the exposure. You know, to see, to be who I am today is just like, you wouldn't believe it coming from where I came from. You know, and I didn't even have the crazy circumstances. I had a mom and dad, grandmas, and loving family. But just to know that, you know, now that I'm older and, like, people are, I know my worth. You know, I travel the world and people pay me for what I naturally do. It's like, okay, you know, this is what it is. But to think that I was only attached to basketball, where somebody could tell me, go do this, go do that, you're not doing that right, it's just like, wow, there's a whole bigger world out here, and I've thrown myself into it. And now I realize that since I've reached this platform, and I'm very thankful for Fashion Week for just like really shining the light on it, it's like I have to put out for everybody who's watching, and then the ones who are coming up like me, who are not only growing up in circumstances that may not be the best, but the ones who are, because I feel like I've seen both sides of it, because I'm very, very connected in the corporate world as well when it comes down to doing videos and motivational speaking. So I see both ends of the spectrum. And for me, it's like I have to be the one to bridge the gap and help people on the other side understand, like, you know, you are blessed to have these things, you know, like other people don't have it as good as you do. And to be able to pour that compassion in there as well, you know, like you said, like you couldn't imagine what it's like to go through those circumstances. And for me to be in it, I didn't go through a lot. You know, I've had friends killed and seen a lot of crazy things, but I wasn't actually in it. So that still makes me, you know, my own little piece. But to know that when I got to Kearney, there were kids who just were living with way different circumstances, you know, and to see the things that they would complain about, it was just like, wow, you know, this is a completely different world. So for me, it's like I realized that I just have to be that person to put out and sort of open up the doors to touch every single mind that I encounter, no matter what race, where you come from.
And I imagine you look back and you don't think, boy, I wish I hadn't played basketball. In the same way that you're talking to kids now, and the message is not give up sports, I imagine, mm-hmm. right?
No, it's not at all. It's like grow your mind and really find your worth. You know, it's crazy because I think that's one of the craziest parts of just like that whole sports thing is that they only, and this is just like the honest truth, they only utilize, you know, you for what you can do for them, and then it's done. You know, and I think that was another hurtful part of the process that was like, it's actually comical now, you know, when I see all of these coaches and the people who, you know, I was...
You felt used.
Yeah, for sure. But it's cool, though, because I needed to go through it. I needed to be the one that they did it to that was going to stand up and say, okay, that wasn't cool. I see exactly what you did. Let's be honest about it. And now we can move forward, because there's going to be other athletes and many that I know who played with me that broke them. When they saw that, oh, no, they don't care about you like that. Like, they're just like, oh, well.
And we could probably spend a full hour talking about how this extends to the college ranks.
Definitely.
And the money that gets made and the money that doesn't trickle down.
Yeah, and it just, that's why knowing your worth is key.
Next, we were joined by a former U.S. senator, a man who won the Iowa caucuses in 1992, and he was the favorite to win the Democratic nomination for president early that year. That is, until Bill Clinton overtook him. But Iowa Senator Tom Harkin spent 30 years in Washington, and even though he retired 3 years ago, he's still working.
Harkin spends most of his time traveling the country, checking on how the ADA is playing out. We're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act. Harkin wrote the bill in 1989. He was in Rochester for a conference on helping people with disabilities find jobs and get out of poverty. Here's Harkin explaining why writing the bill was so personal for him nearly 30 years ago. Then you'll hear from J.D. Flores, a local woman who helped plan that conference, on why it's been tough for her to find a job as a person who uses a wheelchair.
I had an older brother who was disabled. He was deaf. And I saw how he'd been discriminated against in his lifetime. First of all, he was taken from our home in a small town in Iowa, sent halfway across the state to the Iowa School for the Deaf and Dumb.
That was the name of the school?
Well, it wasn't, but that's what everybody called it.
Okay.
And so I remember a couple of things my brother told me that stuck with me forever, and that was, I may be deaf, but I'm not dumb. And so he was segregated away from everybody in school. When he graduated, they told him he could only be one of three things. He could be a baker, a shoe cobbler, or a printer's assistant. And they asked him which one he wanted to be, and he said, I don't want to be any of those things. So they said, okay, you're going to be a baker. He had no choice. And then I saw how he was discriminated against in a lot of things, whether it's shopping. But he was determined to be independent. He was a strong-willed individual that wanted to be independent, didn't want any pity, wanted to make his own way, and was one of the first deaf persons in Iowa to actually get a driver's license because he was told he couldn't drive a car because he was deaf. But he passed all the tests. This would be in 1948, I think. About 1948. And so I saw that. And so my first work when I went to Congress was mostly focused on deafness, communication disorders. And then so when I was on the Senate floor and the ADA passed, I thought I would give my speech on it in sign language. And it was kind of a funny occasion because I started speaking in sign language. Well, the court reporter had no idea what I was saying. Mm. Senator Bob Kerry from Nebraska was sitting in the chair. He didn't know what to do either. And so there was this kind of flurry of activity down in the well. What could they do? Well, I finished my speech, then I gave it verbally. But just kind of an odd moment in the Senate because no one knew what I was saying.
And probably revelatory of the challenges that people can face when all of a sudden very few can communicate.
You know, the other thing I want to say is about the ADA. This was a classic bipartisan bill. First of all, we had this great support of the President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. He really pushed hard on this. He stood behind it all the way. In fact, to the point of pushing his chief of staff, John Sununu, out of the road and replacing him with another person to make sure we could get it through. Interesting story. So he was just wonderful in backing us up from the White House. You said the Chamber of Commerce was opposed to it. They weren't. They were initially.
They came around?
Oh, yes, they did. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce actually supported the final bill.
The final bill. There's all kinds of quotes early on. Oh. NFIB, the Chamber of Commerce, warning that this will cripple small businesses. Oh, I know.
Well, NFIB never supported it.
Okay.
Never.
But the Chamber came around.
The Chamber did. They absolutely did. There was one leader, Tom Donahue, at the Chamber at that time, who decided they would support it. Well, we made some changes and compromises in it, but they did support it. And we got broad support from Republicans and Democrats across the aisle. And I always tell people today about as fractured as our country is right now politically, this is one issue where there has in the past never been party lines, where we can work together across the aisle to bring people together on issues like employment of persons with disabilities, which I hope we get to, because that's what we're here for.
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm focusing my life on. Since I retired, I decided to focus on one thing and one thing only. That is employment of persons with disabilities in competitive integrated employment. Now, that's kind of a key phrase, competitive integrated employment. Not segregated workshops, not sub-minimum wage, but jobs just like everybody else. And we've got great examples of that all over the country. We made some changes in the vocational rehabilitation law to help get young people into competitive integrated employment. That's the key.
Here we are with a poverty rate for people with disabilities in Rochester of 42.1%. And JD and Stephanie looked at me and said, "We're not surprised." You're not surprised?
No, I'm not surprised because, you know, segregation is a healthy sport in this community, in my humble opinion. Again, I can only speak for myself and I can only speak to what I know being true, but let's talk about when you shop. Let's talk about when you're out and about in the community. Let's talk about when you're going to a public setting, a restaurant. How many times do you see people with disabilities? How often is that to you? Like, I've noticed them, you know, my friends notice them, my family members and people who work with people with disabilities notice them because that's our life every day. Those are our teammates. That's who we're looking for when we go into different spaces. But those folks who don't have that connection, how oftentimes do they see them? Because we're not necessarily given the opportunities or the platforms aren't necessarily shared with us in order for us to move up in a company, move up in an organization, or even have the opportunity to just start. So I have to work my way up to an interview and then earn that interview. And then I have to be almost a perfect candidate at that interview to almost get that job, maybe. And if someone comes in after me that just, you know, had one thing different than me, then I lost out because of what the perceptions people have of me and whatever my chair represents to them. My chair's name is Clyde, so if I've referenced Clyde anywhere through this, that's who I'm talking about. But, you know, Clyde is part of my identity. He makes me comfortable in the spaces that I'm in and where I'm going to go. And if Clyde can't come, I can't come. You know, like, there's places here I don't shop because they're not accessible. You know, there's all these other different things that I don't do because they don't align up with my moral code of life. But in a lot of the spaces that we're in, we look at all the employers in the city. There's employers who employ 50,000 plus people in the city. And when you walk through there, how many times do you see folks with disabilities? You know, there's other smaller companies and there's local businesses. How many of those local businesses are actually accessible? Like, how many of them are actually giving people a chance? Now, I'm not trying to shame anyone. There are, you know, people who do. But what I'm saying is that majority don't. And when that happens is when you start talking about expendable wage. Well, we don't have expendable wage. So that's why we wouldn't be in your restaurants. We wouldn't be in your stores because we have no way to make money. And then, you know, if we want to talk on a larger scale of issues, we want to talk about systems. The systems we have in place sometimes hold us back. I went to college. I graduated high school. I'm local. So local all the way. I graduated from Wilson Magnet High School in 2009. I went to Brockport. It's not really local, but it's close enough, in my opinion, to be local. I graduated from Brockport in 2014, and I have yet to find gainful employment where it's not just a year-long contract, or I'm not just a part-timer, or I'm not just a person to come in to volunteer for you or to work for free. Like, it hasn't happened. Now, you can't tell me I don't have the skill, because if I pull my resume out, you'll be surprised. And then you look at me and say, how don't you have a position yet? And it's because the perception of people with disabilities, you know, we have to change our narrative. We have to change the way people look at us. We have to basically really just revamp how people see us and view us, because we've been second-class citizens for a long time.
Next, for the first time on Monday, the city of Rochester will celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. Rochester joins a list of cities that have decided to honor Indigenous peoples, but unlike many other cities, Rochester is not getting rid of Columbus Day. Mayor Lovely Warren says she understands that Columbus Day remains an important holiday for Italian Americans, so Rochester will celebrate both holidays on Monday.
Now, we discussed Christopher Columbus's history and the need to properly honor Italian Americans. A caller named John expressed his view that Christopher Columbus is getting a bad rap, despite the fact that, and yes, it is a fact, Columbus oversaw mass murder, genocide of indigenous peoples, and essentially helped invent the transatlantic slave trade. In this clip, you're going to hear John's call first, followed by Peter Jemison, the historic site manager at Ganondagan.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I have a real problem with this reinterpretation of history. Christopher Columbus was a relatively, you know, inauspicious individual during his time. He was an explorer. He was desperately looking for someone to finance his dream of exploring a better route to India. And quite frankly, you know, he's now vilified in your conversation as, you know, being a murderer and enslaving people. He himself didn't do that. He was a pawn in a much larger era of exploration and conquest that, you know, really had a little to do with him per se. He was searching for money. He couldn't find it in any city-state in Italy. And Italy was not even a country then, quite frankly. And so he went to Spain, and Ferdinand and Isabella had designs on finding riches in the so-called New World or India, wherever. And so they financed his trip. So Christopher Columbus shouldn't be vilified.
So John, I'm listening, but I want to ask you a couple questions here. Who is responsible, if Columbus is leading those expeditions, who's responsible for the murder of hundreds of thousands of indigenous people?
Well, Christopher Columbus himself, nor did the people on the first three boats, didn't slaughter indigenous
I'm not certain
people.
Joseph Stalin murdered anybody himself. Who's responsible for the people who died is what I'm asking you.
Well, I think it represents a much larger picture than just Christopher Columbus. It represents an era in which the European leaders wanted to exploit whatever was out there. And so I think you could actually hold the people responsible were the people who sponsored the trips. But he himself should not be vilified as this evil man. All he did was just an explorer. And so, you know, think about it. I mean, let's not reductio ad absurdum here. This guy was a guy who couldn't find financing and basically said, well, anybody give me some money to go and explore, because he wanted to explore and find a route to India.
Okay, and but so, John, I'm actually responding to the historical account, and I've read a lot of historical accounts. I'm not, you know, sort of saying, well, Columbus led this exhibition, hundreds of thousands of indigenous people died, I'll blame Columbus, even though there's a really good case for blaming the leader of an expedition if that happens. I'm reading the actual accounts from the people who were there and from Columbus's own words. And the only conclusion I can draw is that he did not view his fellow human beings as anything other than property, women something to exploit, the men something to use as labor or to be exploited or killed, and was happy to do it. I don't understand how I'm supposed to. And again, I'm not trying to be combative. I'm just trying to be direct about history. Help me see why that's not correct.
And I think that was probably the view of many leaders and many people during that era. I think that exploitation of conquered people was the MO for most of the leaders of Europe since the fall of the Roman Empire throughout the Dark Ages, and then probably until, well, you can't even say when did it stop, but it was all about conquest. And unfortunately, that was the MO for most of mankind. So, you know, I honestly think we have to look at things in the context of which they occurred, in the period in which they occurred. Their worldview was very different than our worldview. We should learn from them, learn the things that were not good and what they did, and actually not repeat them in our era. That's what we should learn from history. Christopher Columbus, I agree, is not the perfect person to glorify Italian culture. There's so many wonderful things about Italian culture. There's some bad things about Italian. I'm an Italian American. I'm very proud of my heritage, but there's also a lot of things that are not so good about Italian heritage, just as there are a lot of things that are not so good about any culture. Native American culture did a lot of horrible things to each other. They did a lot of warring in between each other and killed a lot of their own people. There was a lot of genocide and fratricide within the Seneca Nation in New York State. The Seneca were very angry and threatened the Oneida and the Onondaga for siding with the Americans, whereas the Seneca sided with the British during the Revolutionary War. So we could vilify any culture. Any culture has done horrible things to its fellow man. What we need to do is learn from those things and move forward, not continually, you know, destroy any you know, good that they may have done.
All right, so John, hang there for a sec. I appreciate the phone call. Peter Jemison from Ganon again wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, John, my biggest concern about the things you've said is that that is not what is currently being taught in most elementary schools when this subject is first introduced to children. What is being taught is this kind of cleaned up version of him going in search of spices, an alternate route to the east, and then, you know, coming upon an island of people and discovering America. I mean, that's the line that I'm sad to say is the one that is still being repeated to most school children. There are schools that are exceptions to that. We deal with a lot of schools at Ganondagan, John. I've got to tell you, from the beginning of, from the middle of September until the end of October, we have school groups morning and afternoon. In the spring, the same thing. These are fourth graders coming from all of the suburban schools, all of the towns, from the city of Rochester. And I can tell you, you know, we've got a pretty good handle on the kind of courses and the way in which things are taught to children. So when does the change begin, John?
Let's close the week with a conversation about an idea we hear often in Rochester. We hear about gentrification. Now, broadly speaking, we're talking about what happens when people who have lived in a neighborhood for a long period of time are forced out by wealthier developers or individuals.
Local organizations are hosting a conference on gentrification later this month. We sat down with Mohammed Ghazali, a man who says he is one of the faces of gentrification, or at least he's one of the people impacted by it. Here's his story of how he was forced out of his home.
This is a very hard subject for me because coming from Somalia in the civil war and then moving to Kenya, living there for, you know, a few years in the camp, and then moving to here, to Rochester, and making Rochester home, being like my first home. And then I lived over River Park Commons, Gateway, Mount Hope, for about 10 years. And basically, I grew up there since, childhood all the way to adulthood. And I only knew growing up that area, you know. In 2008, and we were basically gentrified and pushed out. And all the people that lived there from Somalia and different area of the world that moved here as a refugee, you know, we had our own community and we would help each other. We would, you know, support each other. And now these developers came in and pushed us out, promising us that we would come back. And after it's rebuilt, we would come back and we would have the same community again. And when we got pushed out and all over the place in the city, and we had to start all over again. And when we came back after the place was built, and they said, I'm sorry, you guys don't qualify. It's no 3-4 bedrooms available. They purposely built 2 and 1 bedrooms for the most, you know. Mm-hmm. And also the price, the rent, it was really too much for us to afford. And that's what really hurt me from day one. And I always think about it, as I get older. And that's why I joined, the Land Trust and other community organizers and advocates in the city of Rochester.
Mohammed, can I ask you, when you think about what you thought you were getting into when the developer told you back in 2008, you know, look, you've got to move out. We're rebuilding here, but you'll be able to come back. You'll be able to come back. Did you trust that? Did you think that you were going to be able
yes.
to come back?
Yeah. Yes, because growing up, I was a young guy. I mean, I don't know. I didn't know anything about politics. I didn't know professional liars, you know, and I didn't know all this the way it works, you know. And growing up, I see people just say whatever they want to say. They can lie about the situation. They don't care about your life. Or they don't care about your safety. They don't care, you know, if you sleep safely at night or whatever it is. They only care about their income, you know. How can we make this place better? How can we bring rich people here? And how can we raise taxes so we can have more money for the city, you know?
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the Fashion Cast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Radio 89.5 FM. That's WEOS all across the Finger Lakes region. You have no idea what I wear when I host the program, and it's always very, very fashionable.
He's proud. We'll have to start tweeting some pictures.
No, we probably shouldn't
your
do that.
Your sock-shirt combos. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're also on the WXXI
like
mobile
this.
App. What?
I don't like you making fun.
I'm not making fun.
I'm a very delicate flower with my fashion.
That's true.
Okay.
Well, more on that next week. Thanks for listening, everybody. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you Monday.